Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
This is Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, there's so much in the news. Anthony Taguba, the general who did the investigation, the official investigation on behalf of the Bush administration of Abu Ghraib, has now come out and called George Bush a war criminal. His exact quote, the commander-in-chief and those under him authorized a systematic regime of torture. He said, after years of disclosures by government investigations, media accounts, and reports from human rights organizations, there's no longer any doubt as to whether the current administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account. Good on you, Anthony Taguba. This is a courageous position for this fellow to be taking. Also here in Oregon, we've seen this whole hoop-de-doop about the fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints and all the wives and these guys being herded, these children being herded around or herded off by state protective services. Arguments of the possibility of abuse, but the larger crime, I think, was polygamy, at least in the, broadly speaking, in the public mind. Here in Oregon, there is a sect, the Followers of Christ Church. They based out of Oregon City, which is just down the road from me here in Portland. We've drive down there for lunch. Four months ago, a little girl who was one of their children died for lack of medical treatment. And yesterday, a 16-year-old boy in their sect died. He had a condition that was easily treatable, where he was not passing urine and he had a bladder problem, and it backed up into his kidneys, wiped out his kidneys and killed him. The question, he's 16 years old, and under Oregon law, he can make his own medical decisions. And he chose not to be treated, which means essentially he chose to die. At what point does the state step in? At what point do we say no to people who are members of religious cults or sects that will have nothing to do with modern religion? So it's an interesting question, and I'd like to get into that a little bit more too. Coming up on our program today, in our second hour, we're going to be talking with Yaron Brook. He is the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, about the whole debate around salmonella. And we're finding more people are sick from salmonella in our tomatoes. And this is, I think, a variation on, whether or not you should, be allowed to treat illness with prayer. Should government treat sick tomatoes by ignoring them with the so-called free market? Another, in my opinion, religious debate. This will be at the top of the second hour of our program. And in the third hour of our program, Charlie Derber is going to drop by. He and his co-author, Catherine Adam. Adam's the author of 12 books. This, The New Feminized Majority, How Democrats Can Change America with Women's Values. And that should be interesting. Christy Harvey's going to drop by. Right now, Rory O'Connor is with us. He's an award-winning filmmaker and journalist, co-founder and president of the international media firm Global Vision, Inc., and board chair of the Global Center, an affiliated nonprofit. He's also editorial director of the Social News Network. Websites roryoconnor.org and newstrust.net. Hey, Rory, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Your book and your new book is Shock Jocks, Hate Speech and Talk Radio. And this is a great topic, I'm telling you. Let me just, for example, here, our good friend Michael Wiener.
When I see a woman walking around with a burqa, I see a Nazi. That's what I see. How do you like that? A hateful Nazi would like to cut your throat and kill your children. Don't give me this crap that they're doing it out of a sacred ritual or rite. It's not required by the Quran that a woman walk around in a 7th century drape. She's doing it to spit in your face. She's saying, you white moron, I'm going to kill you if I can. That's how I see it. What do you want me to do, mince words with you? I'm not going to mince words. We're too far gone in this country.
Yeah. So is that hate speech?
Say that again, huh?
Well, and Michael Reagan, this is pretty amazing. There's a fellow by the name of Mark Dice who was sending the government did it 9/11 type videos, what some might consider conspiracy type videos, to some of the troops. And Michael Reagan went off on him on his radio show last week. Here's a clip of it.
There's a group that's sending letters to our troops in Iraq and DVDs claiming 9/11 was an inside job.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that they should rethink why they're fighting. Man, they ought to take these. Excuse me, folks. I'm going to say this. We ought to find the people who are doing this, take them out, and shoot them. Really. Just find the people who are sending those letters to our troops to demoralize our troops and do what they're doing. You take them out. They are traitors to this country, and shoot them.
Now, that was just the beginning of it, the first 30 seconds. Then he continued to go on to encourage people to commit murder, you know, the type of assassination that his father almost suffered at the hands of, what was it, Mark Chapman?
John Hinckley.
John Hinckley, that's right. I'm mixing up John Lennon and Ronald Reagan. Anyhow, here's Michael Reagan.
You have a problem with that? Deal with it. But anybody who would do that doesn't deserve to live. You shoot them. You call them traitors. That's what they are. And you shoot them dead. I'll pay for the bullet.
He'll pay for the bullet. Now, tell me, what's the state of talk radio right now, Rory O'Connor?
Well, I think the state of talk radio is that, unfortunately, we could take up all of our allotted time playing clips from Michael Savage and Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and their ilk, exactly along the lines of what we've just heard. You know, it's not unusual for these jocks. They regularly compare people they disagree with politically to Hitler, to the Nazis, to the KKK.
Hey, wait a second. I've compared George Bush to Hitler and the Nazis and the KKK. Does that make me a hate jock?
No, it doesn't mean you're a hate jock necessarily, but it is something that, you know, personally I avoid doing. I don't think it is good for democratic discourse to go around calling other people Hitler. And also, you know, quite honestly, you know, that's something that's used.
Now, calling somebody Hitler and making a comparison is a different thing.
Yes, but my point is that, you know, there's many, many examples of this. Michael Reagan, in fact, is someone who did speak to me for my book, and he's interviewed. Ironically, I asked him, do you have any liberal friends? And he said, most of my friends are liberal. My closest friend is Alan Colmes. So I think what you see with Reagan, who honestly is a little bit more rational than he sounded in that clip, is that this is a slippery slope. That
well, in fact,
into outrage, you know, where will it end?
Yeah, I've been on Fox. I've debated Michael Reagan a couple of times on Fox News, and he always struck me as a very rational guy. I think that was probably an aberration. On the other hand, that kind of thing, not specifically that kind of thing, but, you know, Michael Savage calling Diane Sawyer a whore, Michael Savage calling Barbara Walters a slut. You know, I've got all these clips here. This is the norm.
They regularly call women whores, as you know. You know, look at the whole infamous Don Imus affair. You know, Rush Limbaugh calling for riots at the Democratic National Convention in Denver. Bill O'Reilly mentioning Michelle Obama and a lynching party in the same breath. We could go on.
So what do we do about this? What do we do about this, Rory? We've got 2 minutes here to solve the problems of the world.
What we need to do is we need to exercise our free speech. We need to confront hate speech wherever and whenever we find it. And we need to hold the media accountable. We need to hold the advertisers accountable. We need to form bridges with the employees at the media companies that are distributing this. You know, one of the reasons Don Imus was taken off of MSNBC in the wake of his nappy headed hose remark is because the employees at NBC, led by Al Roker, of all people, were up in arms. And they said, this is not representative of who we are. Is this representative of the corporation we work for?
Right. And the advertisers blew back as well. At what point, though, does this have a chilling effect on the First Amendment? At what point does this echo back on Programs like this or don't we honor free speech in the United States?
We honor free speech in the United States, and we would most honor free speech by exercising our own free speech in the manner that I just described, and by confronting what I argue in my book is not free speech, but is hate speech, and it's hate speech that all too often leads to hate acts. You know, there are unfortunately a lot of deranged people out there, and I'm concerned that someone listening to that Michael Reagan clip might say, hey, that's a good idea.
Yeah, well, I was too, and that's why I went off on it last week. But I am also concerned about the targeting of. I think, frankly, that what's going to happen is as America becomes a more tolerant society, I think we are, that the hate speech is going to fall away. I think these guys are starting to really sag in the ratings.
Well, I hope that's the case, and I think that the progressive alternatives, you know, people like you in Air America, Stephanie Miller, you know, there's a whole range of people I could mention, are in the ascendant.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. Rory O'Connor, his new book, Shock Jocks, Hate Speech and Talk Radio. Thanks, Rory.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
Tom Hartman radio program. Steve Rosenbaum, back about a week ago, wrote a very thought-provoking piece at Huffington Post, and it's kind of gone viral all around the internet. And when I first read it, my thought was, this is just too weird to be possible. Sort of like, you know, the parents wouldn't let their kids have medical care. Is that too weird to be possible? But or a talk show host saying that he'll pay for the bullets to have somebody assassinated. In this case, Mark Dice, the guy who was sending these things. But he was the victim, not the perpetrator. But here it is. Steve Rosenbaum is suggesting that John McCain is not going to be the Republican nominee. Now, it's not because he's expecting an assassination or anything like that. And actually, over at Alternet, there was a piece called Domestic Terrorists Plotting Against Obama, and they've actually cracked up, apparently, a couple of rings or arrested a few individuals who have in their mind the idea of assassinating Barack Obama already. But it's not about that with regard to McCain. It's that the Republicans are looking at the polls, and they figured out this guy can't win. And if they don't have a Republican president in 2009, now, Steve Rosenbaum doesn't go here. This is my conjecture, but let me just add to his theory. If they don't have, in my humble opinion, if they don't have a Republican president in 2009, there's a very good chance that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, perhaps Colin Powell, David Addington, Doug Feith, Paul Wolfowitz, that many of these guys and a lot of their underlings, from the Sarah Taylors of the world to the Lura Canaries of the world to that many of these people who basically politicized the office of the executive branch, the office of the presidency, and used the tools and powers of government to destroy Democrats for political purposes, that these people are going to end up, or who committed war crimes, who are directly responsible for war crimes, that these people are going to end up in prison, at the very least disgraced and prosecuted, at the very most imprisoned, and possibly some of them even being executed for war crimes. And so there's just no way the Republicans are going to allow this to happen. As Steve Rosenbaum points out, he says, you don't ever throw a game, and they're not going to throw this one. So why is McCain going? How is it? He says at some point in mid-August, John McCain is going to announce that he has decided he cannot accept his party's nomination for president. The reason will be health-related, and that may turn out to be the truth. And he points out, you know, McCain's in his 70s, and he's really starting to look like he's being ground down by this campaign. I mean, this is something that exhausts a 30 or 40 or 50 year old. McCain's 70. But he says the main reason is that they figured out that this guy can't win. So the pressure is going to be on John McCain to withdraw, to not run for president of the United States. And if he pulls out in August, just before or at the time of the Republican convention, if he pulls out then and they insert somebody else, that person will have the patina of new and fresh that Barack Obama has right now. That person will be able to claim the mantle of change that Barack Obama is holding now. That person will be able to make a clean break with Bush and Bush's policies, particularly with regard to the war in Iraq and the economy, as McCain can't do now, but Obama has been able to. In other words, if they pick the right person, and the timing is this exquisite, just months before the election, there's every chance that that person can become the change candidate, can run and actually win the White House for the Republicans, thus forestalling the prosecution, the criminal prosecution of all these guys, these fat cats with tons of dollars in their back pockets and all this kind of thing. And who's it going to be? His list includes Mitt Romney, Charlie Crist, Bobby Jindal, Michael Bloomberg, Chuck Hagel, Dick Lugar, Mark Sanford, Tim Pawlenty, Condi Rice, Colin Powell, Marilyn Musgrave. I think the leading candidates, frankly, are Chuck Hagel and Michael Bloomberg, the non-Republican Republicans, or Mitt Romney. As you know, I'm convinced Mitt Romney is going to be the vice presidential nominee. It wouldn't surprise me at all if he became the presidential nominee. He's a guy right out of central casting, plus he's got a couple hundred million bucks in his back pocket. He can bankroll his own election. And he did well in the primaries, relatively speaking. So is John McCain going to drop out? You heard it first, well, from Steve Rosenbaum over at the Huffington Post and here. And that'll certainly, speaking of the shock jocks and the hate jocks, that'll certainly please them, right? Because they're all going gung-ho. They're hating John McCain. And again, it might even cause the Limbaughs of the world to say, see, we influenced politics once again. Yeah, I mean, a lot of possibilities here. A lot of possibilities. A lot of directions this thing should go. By the way, the FISA bill may come before the House again today. Once again, call your member of Congress, your member of the House of Representatives, your two senators, and say, no immunity for telcos. You can get the phone number over at callcongress.org. We'll be picking up your calls right after the break, 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Over at the Liberal Radio Network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah, thank you, Bill. 34 minutes past the hour, and there's crazy things in the world beyond just Bill O'Reilly. I'll tell you. Yeah, sustainably freshen your air with sheep poo. Yes, that's right. In an effort to move to a greener lifestyle, a company in Wales, Creative Paper Wales, has developed Poopery, air fresheners made from sheep poo. No need to fret, though. They thoroughly sterilize it relentlessly, washing it and boiling it until only 50%. The undigested cellulose remains. Then through labor love, they beat it to a pulp. papermaking pulp, that is. Then they turn the poo into paper using traditional papermaking techniques, which are then fragranced with the scent of daffodils and fresh-cut grass. Yeah, no, you think I'm kidding? Go to sheeppoopaper.com. It's real. Oh, it's almost as strange as Michael Savage.
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill him.
Yeah, where to kill him. Yeah. Kill him. Yeah, that's what we got to do. Amazing. Jake in Eureka, California. Hey, Jake, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I was just calling to point out the hypocrisy of Michael Wiener, otherwise known as Michael Savage. This guy, he does a horrifically homophobic radio show where he rails against gayers every single day. But wasn't it Allen Ginsberg, before he died, who came out and went public and said he had a relationship with Michael Savage, otherwise known as Michael Wiener, back
well,
in the day?
I don't recall. I do know that Savage followed Ginsberg around, hung out with him for a while, sent him a love letter, had photos taken with him, nude, things like that. But, Allen Ginsberg was a cultural icon as well as a gay man. I mean, that may or may not mean that they had a gay relationship. I know that there are people who point out the stereotype stuff. You know, Michael Savage over on his website has all the pictures of his little fluffy dog and all that kind of stuff. But I would, rather than going after him as an individual and at the same time, by the way, implying that, you know, there's something wrong with being gay, and I get it, that what you're pointing out is the hypocrisy.
No, I'm not trying to do that, Tom.
Yeah. No, I get it. What you're saying is that he's trashing gay people all the time. You know, maybe this is an indication of some deep-seated psychological problem or whatever, but let's just stick to the, you know, it's wrong that he's trashing gay people.
Well, exactly. I think it's the hypocrisy issue. It's the whole point that he's out there and he's attacking gay people every single day. It's like he maybe has something to hide, and I think it's unfortunate he has to take it out on other people.
Yeah. I'll go along with that. Thanks, Jay. Tim in Los Angeles. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I'm also your regular in your chat room.
Oh, great. Great.
Yeah.
I'm reading the chat room right now. In fact,
well, I'm not there right now.
Oh, but, Fred 42, just the Savage Wiener is. Anyhow, yeah.
Well, the reason why I'm calling is because I was calling regarding the, you know, the shock jock.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my comment about shock jock is the most famous shock jock who had like 15 million listeners was Howard Stern. And the reason why he was popular is because people wanted to know what he was going to say. So I guess my suggestion is, minus Michael Reagan, who made that threat, terrorist threat, which is a felony in the state of California, is to ignore the people, because when Stern was on terrestrial radio, he talked about sex, and both the left and the right were railing on him. They said they should get him off the air, blah, 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 and people were actually listening. On the other hand, when Savage speaks or when Limbaugh speaks, no one really hears.
I think that there's a natural I'm not so offended by all this stuff, first of all. Let me just put that
neither
out. And secondly, I think that there's a natural progression. I don't claim to be a student of Father Coughlin, of the history of his life and all that kind of thing. I know there are people who have done extensive biographies of him. But I have spent a fair amount of time over the years collecting clips of his. Unfortunately, I had a whole collection of really great Coughlin clips that I used to play in the first 2-3 years of the show, and I had a computer crash and they're all gone, and I've just not taken the time to dig back through the internet and find them all over again and edit, because I was taking, you know, half hour shows and editing them down to 2.5 minutes and pulling out the what I thought were the really cool moments. But, you know, what happened with Father Coughlin, who was the first shock jock. I mean, he started in radio, and I don't remember if it was late 20s or early 30s, but, you know, he was a big booster for Roosevelt in the election of 32. You know, that Roosevelt was going to save the nation. And then around 35, when Roosevelt was pushing Social Security, Father Coughlin just went nuts. He went over the edge, and by 36, 37, he was calling Roosevelt the Antichrist, and then he was going, and he was also arguing very strongly in 36, 37, 38, against our getting into the war with Germany, because Hitler was such a good, outstanding man, and implicitly he was suggesting that those Jews in Europe were just getting what they deserved. I mean, that was Father Coughlin was doing these incredible anti-Semitic rants. And what happened was that in the early part of his career, literally a third of Americans listened to his show. Now, granted, there was no television, there was only radio, and there were only two radio networks at the time. There's the Red and the Blue Network, as I recall. And then they became NBC and CBS, and then ABC came along. But so there was a very limited palette, but nonetheless, a third of America was listening. Toward the end of his career, his listenership had just fallen off the face of the earth. People just didn't want to hear it. You know, it wasn't just that there were other options, and the Catholic Church finally retired him, you know, out of embarrassment, I think, in large part, and the record indicates to me that he probably was developing Alzheimer's pretty badly in the last year of his being on the air. But I think that that's what happens, that eventually people just say, okay, I got it, enough of that, you know, and that's what's happening. I think it's one of the reasons, in part, one of the reasons why in two different major markets in the United States now in the last couple of years, I've beat Rush Limbaugh on the ratings. I go up, you know, head to head with Rush Limbaugh. I have for 6 years now, noon to three Eastern time on this program, and I'm beating him. You know, I beat him in the last, in the Winter Arbitron book. And I think in part it's because I do a good show. I think in part, though, it's because he's losing listeners. People are just saying, nah, because Rush Limbaugh, you know, historically, and we should all give him the credit for this. Rush Limbaugh historically did a pretty good talk show. You might disagree radically with his politics, but he knew how to be a talk show host.
Because I think it was like 2 or 3 years ago, he had 30 million listeners.
Well, he claimed that. Everybody, you know, inflates their numbers. That's
well, what happened was that I was talking to some folks at Premier where he worked out of. They said he dropped down to 10 million.
Yeah, and that's
drastically.
Yeah, and then you're seeing, you know,
more bored of him.
Right, and by the standards that he's using to come up with those numbers,
right.
You know, the way that they're measuring those numbers, you know, taking Cume and in unrated markets, taking a percentage of the market and adding it in and all that kind of thing, you know, probably the top two or three or four of the progressive shows are pulling in somewhere between 2 and 3 million listeners. Maybe,
right.
You know, I mean, I've had people working out with our show suggesting that we should be claiming 3.5 or 4 million listeners. I'm just not ready to blow out numbers like that. But I think the bottom line is that, you know, certainly 3 million is probably reasonable. But the bottom line is that I think that conservative talk radio is beginning to diminish. I don't think it's ever going to go away. I think it's just going to recede into the margins, much like Howard Stern did on XM or Sirius, I guess it is.
Right.
That progressive talk radio is going to come from the margins into the mainstream, and there's ultimately going to be a balance. I think that we're just heading in that direction. Tim, thank you for the call, and thanks for a voice of rationality here. From Tim to Tim. Tim in Detroit, listening on WDTW.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hey.
I think one way to deal with a lot of this is, well, it's not through the fairness doctrine, which a lot of people advocate, but to reapply the Sherman Antitrust Act, and where there's media concentration as there appears to be, to simply break up a lot of these media monopolies.
Yeah, although let me tell you, Tim, at a certain level, you know, I'm totally in favor of that for other reasons. But I'll tell you, you know, I worked as a DJ starting in the late 60s, in 68, at WITL in Lansing, Michigan. I was a DJ for 3 years. I did rock and roll, top 40 morning drive, Drake format morning drive, and country and western, and even easy listening for a short time. I was a program director for a year. I did news for 7 years. I've seen every side of this business, and I've been doing this nationally syndicated show for 6 years now. So, you know, over the last 40 years, I got 16 years on the air continuously. And I can tell you that there is no other industry that is as risk averse as the radio industry. Program directors, when they're deciding what to put on the air, their number one question in their mind is, will I get fired if I put this guy on the air? Or will I become a star? And the first couple of years, the first 2-3 years that Limbaugh was on the air, he started out on a lot of relatively small stations and it had a hard time getting clearance. And after the money ran out, after the initial seed money, you know, where they were kind of basically buying him onto the air in his first 54 markets, when that ran out, he went through this thing about a year and a half into his show where he was begging his listeners to let his advertisers know that they were listening. It took arguably 4 or 5 years before advertisers looked at the Limbaugh show and said, hey, it's just radio. And I think that, you know, Progressive Talk Radio is now, Air America has been around 4 years. Progressive Talk Radio, this show's been around, we're in our sixth year. A couple of other shows are in their fifth year. Progressive Talk Radio is kind of at that stage.
Uh-huh.
And I think that we're entering into the mainstream.
So you found sort of a curve with talk radio of a format.
Absolutely. And so I'm not... I don't see it as any kind of conspiracy. I know people who program radio stations all over the country. I know most of the program directors that carry our shows. Some of them are conservatives. Some of them are liberals. Most of them just want good programming. They just want to know that their advertisers are going to get value for their money and that they're going to have a show that people listen to so that they can make their payroll. I mean, that's really what they're all about. And for that matter, I'd say, and let me point out, Clear Channel, which is this big media conglomerate, is carrying probably 80% of all the, in terms of listenership, 80% of all the progressive programming in America. So I don't quite buy the conspiracy theory. And although, as I said, I do think that there's an argument to be made for the same company not owning radio stations, television stations, break up the Murdoch empire. I'm all in favor of that. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Before the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at teamster.org. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Eric in Humboldt County, California. Welcome to the show, Eric. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to actually rebut against the attacks I hear on your show sometimes about Michael Savage. I think actually your show and Michael Savage's show and also Art Bell and Michael Moore all have a lot in common in the sense that you guys are independent thinkers, and it seems like the opposing party, be it left or right, seems to take tiny little clips of them and take them out of context. And, of course, Michael Savage gets excited sometimes. I mean, and so do you. And I think both your shows are similar in the sense that you both refer to George Bush as being pretty much an incompetent bumbler, and which is pretty much true, and you both oppose, say, like the free trade agreement. There's no such thing as free trade. I've heard Michael Savage say that a million times, that the oligarchy runs the country, and it's two card Monty.
Eric, let me agree with you.
Yeah. And really,
just let me agree with you for a second. See where this goes. This is probably not going to be the most popular thing I ever said for people who have never heard the Michael Savage show or most of right wing talk radio. I listen to a broad spectrum of talk radio because it's the business that I'm in. It's what I do for a living.
Right.
I had not listened to Michael Savage's show before I started doing this program. And he's on the air in the afternoon here in Portland when I'm driving around. And so I do listen to him from time to time. And Michael Savage, I agree with you. He is the thing that is going to keep his show alive is that he is independent of any particular posture. The thing that is killing the Sean Hannity show is that Sean Hannity does nothing but repeat the Republican talking points. I get the memos in the morning. I can tell you what Sean Hannity's show is going to be that afternoon.
I totally agree with you.
Absolutely predictable. Limbaugh is absolutely repeating the line of the hard right within the Republican Party, the corporate right. It's whatever is in the best interest, ever since Limbaugh got his $170 million for his show, whatever's in the interest of the very, very wealthy among us, that's the position Limbaugh is going to take, and people are figuring that out, and it's predictable. Savage is absolutely unpredictable. You never know which direction he's going to go, and he does theatrical radio. He does good radio, in my opinion. So I think that his show is going to stick around. I do condemn his saying things like,
it's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill him.
I don't think that I've ever called for anybody to kill anybody on this show, and I certainly wouldn't. So I think that there is a distinction, but I agree with you that it may be a fine distinction. But on the other hand, it may be that fine distinction between, yelling hello in a theater and yelling fire in a theater.
That's kind of how I see it. And, it's like you can't if you're on the radio several hours a day, it would be really easy for someone with a mini disc recorder to record you for several hours and then piece together some sort of bizarre clip and make you sound like a lunatic.
Sure. And frankly, if they did it and it got a lot of publicity, it probably wouldn't hurt the show. I mean, that's the other thing. Michael Savage, every time I mention his name, he's going, hey, cool, another one.
Well, you know, you'll never hear on his show him taking other people, except for when he's making fun of Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity. And I know his show isn't comedy, but when he imitates Rush or Sean, it is very funny because he's very poignant, and they are very much right-wing hacks. And I got to give it to you. You don't tote the what I would call the Air America line, and I give it to Savage. He doesn't tote the right-wing line. Same thing with Michael Moore. And it's just it's attacks from the other side, and these guys think for themselves, and they're not always correct, but you've got to respect the independent thinker who doesn't bow down to anybody else.
Yeah, there you go. As I said, I don't disagree with you, Eric. And let me add, to the best of my knowledge, there is no Air America line. I have never had anybody... I get paychecks from two different companies. I do a local show here on KPOJ in Portland for Clear Channel, and I do a, you know, this show for Air America. And neither company, in the 6 years that I've been doing this, and I've been affiliated with a bunch. Actually, I started out, I was syndicated by IE America Radio back 6 years ago, which was owned by the UAW. And it was me and Mike Malloy and Peter Werby and Peter B. Collins and Cenk, the Young Turks, and Nancy Skinner and Doug Steffen. And they never told me what to say. I've never had anybody in this business tell me what to say or what not to say, for that matter. So I suspect that right across the board, there's a general reluctance to tell talent what to say. Because talent would blow back fast, I'm telling you. Al in Merritt Island, Florida. Hey, Al.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah, we got about a minute here. What's up?
Okay, quickly. When I used to travel with NASA out to Texas and out to California, I saw in the countryside lots of oil wells, some working and some capped, and seemed to be waiting. Do they have a bunch out there that are just waiting to be opened up?
They do. The oil companies, they put this on their books as recoverable reserves, and it increases the value of their stock, and they're sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars worth of undrilled oil that is under the ground, and they're sitting on hundreds of millions of acres of land that is leased, and tens of thousands, at least 10,000 licenses, permits to drill, that they are not using because they're waiting for the price of oil to go up. That's the bottom line. It's very simple. There's a couple of the Democrats in Congress have done a very good job of publicizing this, and there's been a couple of good studies on this. So anyhow, that's out there. John in Los Angeles. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hey.
I just wanted to say, ask you and your listeners to think also whether or not you by claiming that your radio show is pure, true people's radio and listener supported, if you don't set yourself up for a conflict of
no, my assertion is that this,
excuse me, I haven't finished yet.
Yeah, but John, I know where you're going. How dare you have commercials from corporations, right?
How do you know?
Because I've heard it before. How dare you have commercials from corporations? You must be conflicted. Well, no, I'm sorry. Yes, we are commercial talk radio. Commercial talk radio is, in my opinion, a good thing. And if people do want to support this show, they can support our sponsors or at least let them know that they're listening. And I see no problem with that, frankly. And if a tobacco company came along and said, we want to sponsor your show, I'd say, no, thanks. I don't want your money. So, you know, there are limits or a slaughterhouse. Or something, but it's 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next, Yaron Brook. Speaking of corporations, president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Who's watching out for your food? And should we be? Should the government be checking out our food supply? Stick around.
Tom Hartman.
Joining the fight by taking on the right.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let's talk life and death here. Welcome back. We are importing more and more food into the United States, yet since George Bush came into office, the number of foreign firms that are inspected, food coming from foreign individual corporate sources, although the number has exploded, the number of inspections by the USDA and the FDA has dropped in half. The number of foreign countries where we inspect food at point of source has dropped in half. The FDA is planning on spending $90 million on their food protection plan in the years 2008-2009. That's this upcoming fiscal year begins in October. According to the GAO, if they were actually to inspect each of the approximately 65,500 domestic food firms that are regulated by the FDA, if they just inspected all of them once a year, that cost would be $524 million. Instead, their budget, $90 million. And in the midst of this, federal inspectors said that 167 people in 17 states have now become ill after eating fresh tomatoes. It's still popping up. They're still trying to figure out exactly where it's coming from, because the record keeping isn't all that clean. Should government even be doing this? Yaron Brook is the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, A-Y-N-R-A-N-D, AynRand.org is their website. Ayn Rand, the author of Atlas Shrugged, the original thinkers of the objectivist movement, from which has sprung the semi-corrupted libertarian movement and the badly corrupted Republican conservative movement. But the original thinkers in this regard, the objectivists. Yaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you back. It's been a while since we've talked.
It has been.
Here's the question. I know in advance that you're going to say that the federal government should have no business inspecting food, that this is something the free market will solve, problem the free market will solve. So here's the question. How does the free market prevent harms in advance? I mean, how does the free market solve this problem without a bunch of people dying first?
Sure. No, I think the way it solves it is by creating a system of liability where grocers and everybody along the supply chains knows the consequence of what will happen if something bad happens, and therefore put in place the kind of the precautionary measures that are necessary in order to prevent these things from happening.
But that's not a free market solution.
That is a market solution.
No, it's not. That's a big government solution. That's the government enforcing a prosecution against people who put bad food into the food supply.
No, I think that what is used is what was used a long time ago. That is common law. That is the liability system. You don't need a government regulator in order to enforce these kind of liability mechanisms.
Well, you need a government to define what the liability,
absolutely,
the limits of liability are.
That's one of the differences between me and libertarians. I believe in a strong government that does only one thing but does it really, really well, and that's protect individual rights and define things like what a liability is and what, you know, how do you proceed with a lawsuit and what is suable and what is not. But I think that as a consequence, what you would get is, I think the market would provide us with rating agencies over maybe supermarket chains or maybe over suppliers. I think that it would do a much better job of the FDA. The incentives are there. You can make money doing this kind of thing. But there's no incentive today. We have gotten used to Big Brother protecting us.
But there's liability already. I mean, look at the multi-million dollar tobacco lawsuits recently. When there was a big meatpacking company that was involved in a scandal during the first Bush administration.
Sure.
And over 100 people died as a consequence of this. And they had just turned off their detector, which was telling them that they had either salmonella or E. coli. I forget which one. Yeah. And, you know, they ended up paying huge fines. That has not stopped this. And what about the outliers?
That's because the FDA exists. That is, the FDA, in a sense, gives a free pass to all these people saying, don't worry about food safety. It tells us, the public, and it tells the supermarket chains and the food suppliers, don't worry about food safety. That's our job. We'll take care of it.
And they did before the Bush administration came along and took them apart.
What's that?
And they did take care of it before the Bush administration came along and started defunding their work.
That's not true, and you know it. I mean, during the Clinton administration, there wasn't a problem. What was it? The fast food chain, where there was E. coli. I mean, these things are always going to happen. And really, you know, let's look at the numbers. Not that I'm here to defend the Bush administration. I think they're awful. But, you know, we're talking about 228. The latest number is actually 228 people in 23 states that have been hurt by salmonella. And I wouldn't want to be one of those 228. It's horrible. But it's 228 out of 300 and something million people. You know, if this happens once a year, you know, this is reason to pour gazillions of dollars into a government bureaucracy to make food prices dramatically more expensive?
Well, no, wait a minute. First of all, we're not talking gazillions of dollars. We're talking $500 million. We're talking the cost of a rack for one day. number one. And secondly, we're not just talking about tomatoes. We're talking about the entire food supply of the United States protected for that $500 million.
You eat every day out of that food supply. I eat every day out of that food supply. 300-plus million people eat every day.
Right. The FDA is doing a pretty good job.
If once a year a few hundred people seem to get ill because of something contaminated, I mean...
But those free market protections that you're talking about, Yaron, were in place back in 1918 or whenever it was that...
Even in a free market, some people are going to get sick. Look,
that Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle.
There's no way to create a system that is risk-free. And if we try, then we're going to destroy the freedoms that we have.
No, but I am arguing that we collectively, as a society, we the people, have the right... to say there are areas that have to do with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, specifically in this case, life. And we have the right to create institutions that will ensure or that will diminish the probability that we will lose our lives.
That is not what the right to life means. The right to life means that you have the right to pursue your life in any way you choose without anybody telling you how to live it. As long as you don't interfere with other
people. The FDA making sure that my food supply is clean is not telling me how to live.
It's your responsibility to make sure your food supply is clean.
But how am I supposed to do that?
The market does that. The market does that for you. And the market would do that if it was left alone.
The market does that marvelously in many of the third world countries where I've been, where almost everybody's barfing all the time or has diarrhea.
You know very well that that's not a market economy where there are no property rights in those countries. There's no rule of law. There's no liability court system. You can't use third world countries examples of capitalism. What we need
is a capitalist
system with strong court system, a strong liability system, in which the government does not tell its citizens, "Don't worry, be happy," because the FDA cop is out to protect
you. So you're suggesting that
the FDA cop can't do the job. It can't, and they never will.
You're suggesting that the government should define the amount of liability.
No,
they should say, "Okay, if you get
government...
sick with salmonella, here's how much you can sue for."
No, the government should define what is legitimate in terms of lawsuits. So it used to be that you could, you could sue for negligence, gross negligence. So it needs to define the rules by which you sue. It shouldn't define amounts, and it shouldn't define, who the party should be. But, for example, the government today provides exclusion from liability for many industries. Because
right.
It says, look, if the FDA has approved it, you can't sue the
No, I agree. That's the bad side of regulation. That's why Monsanto went to the FDA during the Elder Bush administration
Absolutely.
And asked for GMOs to be regulated so they would be, in effect, legalized.
Exactly.
No, I get that.
I think that's absolutely wrong. I think the FDA shouldn't exist. And therefore,
I'm saying that they should exist, and we should be following the precautionary principle. We should be saying you can't put something into the food supply like genetically modified organisms until you have proven that they are safe, proven to our federal agency.
I don't want
to be running around, suing on behalf of my kid who gets sick, thinking that's going to solve it.
Because the knowledge that you can sue is what's going to prevent them from putting it into the food supply.
But you can sue now, and they're putting it in the food supply.
You can't because the FDA protects them from that, and they always have the claim. If you get sick, the supermarket or whatever, they're always going to say.
So you're saying if the people in a democracy collectively say we want to have protection from this,
democracy does not allow you to violate my rights. You want to take my money to fund something you find appealing.
It's our money, Yaron.
It's not our money.
We're members
money,
of we.
Money,
there's a social
money.
Contract here.
I don't
we're members of the society.
Money, Tom. You can keep all of your money, let me keep my money, and then we contractually can trade or not. But don't pull a gun.
We have contractually agreed to be a member of the society by staying in this country.
You don't, by staying in the country, you've agreed that you have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is the exact opposite of what you're advocating for. You're saying you don't have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness if 51% of the people don't want to give you that right or
yes.
don't want to take that right away from you.
Within the constraints of the Constitution. It's called democracy with a small d.
Well, I'm for the protection of individual rights.
You're for capitalism over
democracy.
Democracy.
Can overrule that.
Are you for capitalism over democracy?
Let's have a discussion about democracy next time.
All righty, we'll do it. We'll do it again. Yaron Brook, IonRand.org. Thanks, Yaron.
Tom Hartman.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt. White sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth.
Oh, we're all so organic here. 21 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com for our live chat room and blogs and all of the live video stream, free live video stream, all this other stuff. Bear Stearns, two Bear Stearns executives indicted today. They got their bailout, but they didn't get their amnesty, apparently. Although Congress is looking at giving amnesty to the telco companies, let them know your thoughts on that. 1-866-303-2270. We're seeing the wonders of the free market played out right across the board here. I would submit to you the so-called free market with the Bush administration. The Phil Graham's and Wendy Graham, Phil and Wendy Graham's ending of the Enron loophole, ending of the regulatory powers over commodity trading and energy trading on behalf of Enron, the company that Wendy Graham served on the board of and took $900,000 from. And Phil Graham, of course, the senior economic advisor of the John Cain campaign, one of the major architects of the Enron loophole, which has left us now with the major holder in the United States of oil futures being not ExxonMobil, not Texaco, not British Petroleum, but Morgan Stanley. Say what? The largest holder of oil and oil futures? Yeah, this is downright strange. This is what happens. You wonder why are you paying $4 a gallon for gasoline? Two reasons. One, when Bush came into office, $1 could buy about 120 in euros, 1 euro 20 cents. Maybe 1 euro 30 cents. I don't recall the exact exchange rate back then. Right now, and I'm fixing to head to Europe this weekend, I'll tell you, I'm looking at these numbers. Right now, $1 will buy you about 65 euros, cents, 0.65 euros. So if the price of gas has gone from $2.25 when Bush came into office to $4.50 now, in euros, it hasn't changed at all. And if the euro is a relatively stable commodity or currency, rather, around the world, that means that the dollar has dropped in half in terms of its value. Most of the oil that we're burning, most of the gasoline, is imported. And so it's got nothing to do with anything other than the fact that the currency is being debased. On top of that, you see the price of oil going up. Now, the price of oil has gone up more than twice. Just the price of gasoline has gone up double. The price of oil has gone up more than double since Bush came into office. And with that, there's your Enron loophole. In fact, I would submit to you that the run-up of the price of oil before that had to do with the Enron loophole. So it's pretty straightforward stuff. I mean, this isn't rocket science. 866-303-2270, Scott, Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about
you? All right.
You?
I just wanted to bring up 2 points on your last guest and their free market position. The free market is not a person. The free market doesn't have kids. The free market is this wonderful entity that they always quote, but it has no conscience whatsoever.
It's a social construct.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I wanted to bring up the point that corporations, as was brought up in Mark Green's book, Losing Our Democracy, weigh the outcome of lawsuits as opposed to their profitability. And
that's right.
A great portion of our food supply is controlled by huge corporations like ConAgra. So if they have 228 lawsuits that they have to defend over, you know, the salmonella outbreak, they'll weigh that cost as opposed to, you know, compared to their profitability.
Right. It's like the old memo that came out of, I believe it was Ford, about the Pinto, when there was the concern that these things were exploding on people. And they valued a human life at $250,000, as I recall. I mean, this is, you know, Ralph Nader publicized all this stuff back in the day, and it was either that or it was side saddle gas tanks on trucks. I think that that was it. And they went ahead and made the decision that, okay, if only 1,000 people or 2,000 people are going to die in flames, and that costs us $250,000 per person, that's less expensive than putting a bladder inside these gas tanks so that they don't blow up.
I believe it was an $8 part, too.
Yeah, yeah, it was an more or less an $8 bladder, I think it was, for the gas tanks. And, you know, the bottom line was, say, it's more profitable to have some people die, and that's why we need government regulation. Excellent point. Scott, thank you very much for saying it. Frank in Lake Oswego, Oregon. Hey, Frank, got a minute here before the bottom of the hour break. What's up?
Oh, sure. Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment again on that last caller, the last guest you had on, and it's similar to what the previous caller had mentioned. I just thought it was outrageous that he could get on there and talk about how it's acceptable to have a certain number of people being sick per year, especially when you're talking about food poisoning or with any kind of infection, because you don't know how widespread that could get. I mean, especially when you get into the food sources or water sources, if you don't have some sort of objective independent entity checking for that, you could have massive outbreaks way out of your control.
So spot on, Frank. I mean, the FDA was created back, I think it was 1918 or thereabouts, when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle about the meatpacking industry. And within living memory, there had been these huge cholera epidemics in New York City. And they're just figuring that out. And they said, you know, we're going to protect ourselves. And it's worked pretty good over the years. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at
4 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Drop by our live chat room, TomHartman.com, or over at AirAmerica.com. You can go to the Tom Hartman page, find a link to it. There's also our live video stream over there. Hi. 866-303-2270. I think I said that. Tony in Alexandria, Virginia. Hey, Tony, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I met you at the Green Fest in D.C. last year, and I hope you come to D.C. again because we really like to see you here.
Well, thank you. I'm sure I will be.
I want to say the guy that was just on talking about the free market, it's interesting to me that conservatives who would scoff at Dennis Kucinich for proposing a Department of Peace, because they'll say people are never going to be peaceful, they're evil. They seem to give people a lot of credit for being perfectly educated about every decision that they would ever make in the market, and always making a rational decision. And that seems to be just crazy, because even the example he was giving of the corporations will not market a bad product because the fear of being sued will prevent them from that. But what about the people who misestimate the product that they're marketing, or who, because they're imperfect people, say, well, if somebody sues us, our lawyers are better than theirs, so we don't have to be afraid of that,
right?
Because even if they sue us, we can win.
Or what about where they don't know what the risk is? I mean, when I was a little kid, I used to walk home past a shoe store, and we used to walk in there almost every day and stick our feet in this machine that was a real-time X-ray machine. We called it a fluoroscope. And I could watch the bones in my, you know, my toes wiggling, and I thought that was the coolest thing. And now, you know, looking back on it, I've had massive radiation exposure as a consequence of that. And, you know, they've had to pull those machines. They pulled them off the market in the late 50s, early 60s, because they discovered that the things were causing cancer. You know, they were burning people. They were killing people. But it's like, you know, at the time, I don't think that the company was saying, oh, gee, you know, let's kill some people. They just didn't know.
No, but I think the point, the general point, is that the government is a way for us, as, you know, 300 million people, to apply our money to acquiring a collective knowledge of things and then using that collective
knowledge
to protect ourselves.
That's my point. And that's why I would argue, in fact, I would take it a step further, and I would argue for the precautionary principle, which is what they have in Europe, which is you don't foist a new product upon the people unless that product has been tested, unless that product has had a chance to make it in the marketplace. So.
Right, and I don't think even, you know, I don't really even think it's reasonable to expect an individual business to
laboratory.
Know everything in the
sure.
world about the product that they're doing. I think the idea that we have a government that helps people to know the risks that are out there helps businesses. I think you could even make an argument it saves businesses money because government testing and regulation allows businesses to say, okay, well, you know, somebody's already spent the time and money to figure out that that's not safe, so we're not even going to waste our time looking into it.
Yeah, good point, Tony. And,
thank
you, Tony. And Chris, I got a Chris, our board op. I've lost my connection to the PC there. So if you could put up our callers, I'd appreciate it. And let's go to where do we go here? I forgot where. Bill in Todd Mission, Texas. Hey, Bill.
Good. The John McCain thing dropping out.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, and I'm curious if it's constitutionally possible for George Bush to pardon everyone that he cares about, if he cares about anyone, and then step down and have Dick Cheney pardon him.
It's constitutionally possible. It's practically impossible. I would be astounded if such a thing happened. I think he's just gonna do a high wire act. Although there has been, we've had this discussion on the show with people like Marjorie Cohn, you know, whether or not Bush can actually pardon himself, because the Constitution basically says that he can't use those powers if he's being impeached. I mean, that was the basis. That was the upshot of the U.S. versus Nixon case when Nixon tried to assert executive privilege and tried to assert executive immunity, sovereign immunity during the Watergate case. And the Supreme Court said, no, sorry, if you're being charged with a criminal action in an impeachment hearing, then you don't have those kinds of immunities. And it's one of the strong arguments for impeaching Bush right now, Bill.
Well, when I first thought of it, I thought it was totally unbelievable. But when I look at what this bunch has done, unbelievable is right there all the time. Well, I hope they don't do it.
Yeah. Amen. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Josephine in Michigan. Hey, Josephine.
Hello, Tom. I'm glad to talk to you.
Thanks for calling.
I'm very, very concerned about the upcoming election in 2008,
mm-hmm.
this November,
yeah.
because I've been reading Our Madhouse by Greg Palast,
yeah.
and he details how the election was stolen.
No, Mark Crispin Miller has a Fooled Again, has a great book on that as well.
I will read that one also, but not just by Republicans. There were Democrats who were complicit in it,
sure.
in their states and in their towns and communities that looked the other way. And Bill Richardson was one of them in New Mexico.
How so?
But because he looked the other way, I can't.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah. There was a lot of pressure. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay.
I'm not sure.
My concern is that I called the DNC yesterday to ask them what they were going to do to see that this kind of election fraud doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the standard answer that, oh, we have thousands of lawyers ready to go. Well, you know what the thousands of lawyers did the last four elections? Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So I pressed for more active accounting and monitoring of the system, and the gentleman in Dean's office that answered the phone said, well, because I told him that we can't go through another 4 years of George Bush
mm-hmm.
via McCain. And he said, well, you know, the country's in better shape than it's been in a long time.
Oh, my. Yeah.
I said, with wiretapping, a shredded constitution,
yeah.
torture, bad schools, bad infrastructure, no mass transit. What is better about it?
Yeah.
I said, at least I can speak about schools, because when I went to school in the 30s and 40s, the schools were much better than they are today. And it's not the fault of the people running the schools. It's the fault of the citizens who won't support the schools.
Yeah.
But his answer to me to that was, well, you know, it's all relative.
Yeah,
Josephine,
thank you for the call. I get it, and I guarantee you were not speaking with somebody who speaks for Howard Dean. That said, there does need to be a much more aggressive and principled stance on these issues broadly throughout the Democratic Party. I mean, the Democratic Party that basically got their head in the sand. Lauren, I'm Jason in L.A. Hey, Jason, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom. I'm an attorney. I don't practice any product liability, but, you know, listening to these libertarians, you know, I start to wonder if libertarians, one of the characters in their Dungeons & Dragons game, I mean, they're so out of touch with reality. I mean, the idea that only a couple hundred people got sick from tomatoes, their inability to recognize that that's because we have an FDA. That's, you know, the fact that only a few hundred people get you know, poisoning from toys in China is because we have an FDA.
Yeah, that was my point.
I mean, the amount of regulations and things that you would have to set up to create, you know, first of all, companies would create things and then disappear. We can't even find out where this salmonella is coming, you know, a month into it.
Yeah, and we still don't know the original suppliers of many of the lead-painted toys coming out of China. And those companies, you're right, a lot of them have simply folded or been absorbed by other companies. They just vanish, you know, without a trace. It's totally bizarre.
There are people in this country that would sell, you know, plutonium glow sticks if they could make enough money from it and disappear. I mean, the idea that somehow we're going to have, you know, a legal system that could accommodate, you know, the millions of people that would be injured by incompetent and greedy corporations. I mean, it's obvious that even with this incompetent administration, you know, that you know, a system where it was even, you know, there'd be even more chaos if it was just left to an entire free, unregulated market. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I am agreeing with you. And thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Mary in Los Angeles. Hey, Mary.
Hi. I'm concerned that all of these floods that are going on in the Midwest are not being connected to global warming. And at the very same show, they're talking about how we can get more oil and cheaper oil and let's drill here and let's drill there and let's all, I mean, go to Iraq and steal their oil.
In fact, these Midwest floods were predicted 8 years ago by one of the federal agencies that was measuring the consequences of global warming. I don't have the paper in front of me. It was a story I read a couple of days ago. I think it was NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And absolutely. And the other thing that concerns me is I'm looking at the picture here on the front page of the New York Times online of the Mississippi River bursting its banks in Illinois as it's moving south now from Iowa down to southern Illinois. You know, as it's accumulating more and more water and there's still storms in the region, you know, global warming actually increases the instability in the atmosphere, increases the amount of moisture, the water vapor in the atmosphere, because warm air holds more moisture. And so more moisture falls. So it increases the droughts where there's no moisture and it increases the rain where there's a lot of moisture. And I'm wondering, you know, are they getting ready in New Orleans? Because the last time I looked, that's where the Mississippi ends up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Another thing I need to talk about is this nuclear power plant fiasco that's being planned by McCain. What about all the money that he's planning for the government to subsidize these cancer producing things?
Yeah, it's not just the subsidies. It's the principal thing. And thank you for the call. The principal thing that I think demonstrates the stupidity of nuclear power is that no insurance company in the world, and they're the ones who actually know how to evaluate risk, no insurance company in the world will insure an American nuclear power plant. Period. None of them. And so you and I are insuring them through the Price-Anderson Act. Our government has said, yeah, we'll insure them. In 2000, the National Assessment Synthesis Team of the U.S. Global Climate Change Research Program published a paper titled Climate Change Impacts in the U.S., Potential Consequences of Climate Variability and Change, predicting what's going on right now on the Mississippi River. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Decided it was time to change sides. I'm a Republican now. The party elect. I'm a Republican now.
I got red on my neck.
I'm a Republican now.
We ain't having no sex.
I'm holier than thou. I'm a Republican now.
Yeah, there you go. 9.5 minutes before the hour. It ain't a fine thing. Oh, my. Well, this is an interesting story. This, the Telegraph is reporting that there's a guy in the UK who had metastasized melanoma. And a melanoma is the most aggressive of the three types of skin cancer. And it had metastasized throughout his body into his lymph nodes, one of his lungs. They took some of his white blood cells, the cytokines that attack cancer cells, and cloned them and just injected into him an overwhelming number of his own immune system cells that had been cloned. And he is now cancer-free. Full recovery. This could revolutionize. This is within 8 weeks. He was free of tumor. Within 8 weeks of undergoing the procedure, this could revolutionize cancer treatment. Of course, the research being done in the UK because it involves cloning human cells, something that the Bushies would never allow federal funding for in the United States. 866-303-2270. Dave in Long Beach. Dave, you want to challenge me on Michael Savage?
Just a slight pushback. I understand what you're saying as far as him sometimes going off of the off script, but more often than not,
you know, off the rails.
Well, yeah. I mean,
but we all go off the rails sometimes. Go ahead.
When he goes off script, it's more often to the right of them than it is to the left of them.
My objection, to the extent that I have an objection to Michael Savage and his show, it's that he calls for the death of people. I think that's a line over which we should not step. And when he's calling for people to be killed, I think that that's just too. I mean, I don't even go there. I know people on the left call for the death penalty against the war criminals in the Bush administration, things like that. I don't even go there. I just think calling for killing people is over the top. You know, but well, that said, like I said, I think that he, you know, the guy is a talented talk show host.
Okay, but also, am I still on?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Also, you get a lot of standard right wing hackery. I've heard them say, you know, that the attorney scandal is nothing. You know, so he's not like digging into things and finding the truth about it.
Well, how do you know, Dave? Do you listen to his show?
Well, you tell me this comment about the attorney scandal was many months after, you know, everybody's well aware we'd had congressional hearings and everything that it was unprecedented, these firings. And we know that something's
happening. I know that, but my point is, and I didn't mean that by way of, you know, trying to put you in a box or challenge you. What I'm saying is, and I guess, you know, my excuse is that I'm in this industry, so I need to be listening to a broad spectrum of talk radio, but that's really not an excuse. The fact of the matter is, if somebody on the right is doing entertaining radio, I find that just as interesting as somebody on the left doing entertaining radio. I think there are some really good people on our side, on the left side. There's some really brilliant people who are doing highly entertaining, fascinating talk radio that I love to listen to. And there's a couple of people on the left who do pretty good talk radio. The tragedy is that on the left, there's a lot of people, and on the right, frankly, on both sides. Actually, there's a whole lot more of them on the right. The tragedy on the right is that there are so many of these people who are basically just taking the RNC talking points every day and doing them. And it's not good talk radio. It doesn't work. Now, back to the issue of the caller at the end of the last hour who was saying, you know, basically, how can you be impartial when you take money from advertisers? What's the better solution? I mean, you've got National Public Radio taking money from government and advertisers, essentially, and they're no longer doing investigative journalism into at least into their advertisers. I mean, there is no perfect solution that I can come up with.
Well, can I get in one last comment?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. It's the guy before, the guy who you agreed with a lot about Savage. I there's one thing he said really offended me. Mm-hmm. As far as that he could put together things, snippets of you to make you sound crazy, I'd like to issue him a challenge. Give me any two days of Savage, and he can have a month of you, and I'll out-crazy him every time.
Yeah, maybe. That's not the bottom line. I think the bottom line is that there is a certain Darwinian process in talk radio. I mean, the reason why, Miami just put our show on live, the reason why in a week and a half we're going live in Dallas, the reason, you know, why this show is doing so well and is growing so rapidly is, and is beating Limbaugh in the ratings in some markets, is and I don't mean that to pat myself on the head, is because there are some good there's some good programs on the left, and there, you know, there's some good programming on the right, but there's a real shortage, frankly, in my opinion, of really high quality talk radio, just broadly speaking, right across the board. So,
well, you will agree. Hello.
Yeah, you're still here.
Yeah, you will agree the truth matters a little bit, right? When you talk comparing you and Savage.
I do agree that truth matters. I can't say that I listen to him enough to know when he's, you know, that he's consistently truthful or not truthful. I mean, I probably hear his show once or twice a month. So,
well, okay, take my two-day challenge.
I'm not a heavy consumer of him. Pardon?
Take my two-day challenge.
Okay, all righty, I'll try it out. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Oh, my. Ron in Orange County, California. Hey, Ron.
How you doing, Tom?
Just great.
Great.
Having a good
well,
time.
Great to practice our First Amendment on your radio station.
There you go. There you go.
Okay, yeah, you know, since George Bush, Dick Cheney dragged America through the mud and everything, I'm surprised not a lot of more people are demanding his resignation instead of impeachment. Forget impeachment. Let's get a resignation from
well,
this
guy. Well, that's voluntary, and I think George Bush has demonstrated that he is sufficiently fill in the blank, you know, delusional or narcissistic or whatever. I mean, he believes. Or maybe he's right. I don't know. I mean, this is certainly the position that some people on the right would take, you know, that Sean Hannity would take, is that Bush actually has been a great president and he deserves a whole lot more credit than he gets. And he's patting himself on the back. And that's why he is not resigned. But there's no chance that he's ever going to resign. He needs to be impeached. And keep in mind, impeachment does not mean removal from office. Bill Clinton was impeached. He was not removed from office. And just the process, impeachment happens, thank you, Ron, for the call, impeachment happens in the House of Representatives. And it is merely an indictment. It is not a removal from office. The removal from office happens in the Senate, where there is a trial and either a conviction or an acquittal or a non-conviction. And, you know, Bill Clinton was not convicted in the Senate. He was impeached in the House. I think that George Bush deserves at least the same.
Tom Hartman.
Helping you win the water cooler wars.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Your home for truth in broadcasting.
Now, here's Tom Hartman.
So, what are the standards? What are the... Standards is the wrong word. What are the perspectives, the values, the worldview? Values is, I think, the right word. By which we as a nation and as a planet, as a global community, have the greatest probability of surviving into the future and prospering and thriving as well. That would be nice. But in many ways, we're actually facing survival threats. Catherine Adam and Charles Derber have written a new book, The New Feminized Majority, How Democrats Can Change America with Women's Values. And Charles Derber is on the line with us. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And I should add, you're a professor at Boston College, author of 12 previous books. And Catherine Derber was an undergrad who helped you write this book. And let me just – this is Limbaugh, his take on this kind of stuff.
I have a long
– And let me just turn the volume up here a little bit and we'll restart it.
I have long told you – for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
I mean, there's a group that's sending...
So there's this misogynistic streak. And not just in the right. I think it cuts probably across all political lines among men and among some women, actually, that you look at the work that suggests that what you're referring to as women's values are not actually women's values. They are the values of a very narrow minority who are seeking their own self-interest or people who are somehow out of the mainstream. I mean, this is the argument that the old orange juice lady, I'm forgetting her name right at the moment, essentially made. Your thoughts on this?
Well, the argument that we make in this book is that, a sort of masculinized values, and when talking about masculinized and feminized values, we're not being, it's not in the genes or the DNA. These are just historically conditioned values. And when we talk about a feminized majority, we mean both women and men who have come to hold a set of values that are really quite different than many of the traditional values that have governed American militarism.
For example?
Traditional capitalist values of sort of social Darwinist competition, individualism, everybody gets head on head on their own, and you sink or swim on your own. Right. And by feminized, we mean the recognition of interdependence, of community, of cooperation, collaboration, and so forth. Women, gender gap research surveys show that women are more likely to hold these values than men, but that a large number of men also embrace these values. And what we're trying to argue here is not that, women have become a very core constituency for change in the country, but we're not arguing that this is a women, this is really a block of voters who have come to embrace pretty progressive values. And I think that what holds back a lot of political change is the sort of collusion of both political parties in sort of holding to agendas rooted in more traditional masculinized values, which emphasize, militarism, which emphasize individualism and inequality and so forth. But there's a huge amount of survey data which suggests that actually the mainstream political parties, particularly the Democratic Party, could get a lot more votes, and including a lot of men as well as a great majority of women, if they emphasize these new values.
The Iroquois Confederacy, when Ben Franklin introduced the 34 members of the Iroquois Confederacy who came to the Constitutional Convention in 1787, he got up and he said, I'm paraphrasing from memory, but I think it's pretty close, he said, it should be an amazing thing if six nations of ignorant savages have survived for 1,000 years in peace, and 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can't do the same.
Right.
What he didn't know at the time, or perhaps he did know, Thomas Jefferson certainly knew it, was that among those six tribes, and he didn't mean ignorant savages as a put-down, that was simply how they referred to them, among the Iroquois Confederacy and five of the six Iroquois nations, while the men were the sachems, they traveled, long distances to communicate the needs of one tribe to another and for the annual meetings and things and the seasonal meetings. The only people who could vote, who had decision-making power, were the women. And, the founders of this country flipped that on its head. They said, okay, good idea. Only one gender gets to vote? Yeah, great idea. Make it the men. And
right.
And we've seen what came out of that. Rhianne Eisler's written extensively about this. Dan Quinn has. I have a chapter about this in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, that in those cultures, historically, those cultures that are either matriarchal, matrilineal, that are primarily run by women, or those cultures where there are democratic cultures, like the Iroquois Confederacy, where women, where it, built into the Constitution is the notion of every decision has to be made in the context of the seventh generation, which is fundamentally, the way you describe it, of woman's value. I would say it's a human value. That in those cultures, they tend not to have wars, they tend to survive for a long period of time, and they tend to have a very high quality of life.
Well, let me add to that, Tom. I think I've just done sort of simultaneously a second book called Morality Wars. And
right.
The argument is that's also a book about political morality. And the argument there is that hegemonic powers, that is, dominant powers, have tended very much to use – I raise this in the context of how you opened this discussion around survival. What in the new feminized majority we talk about as masculinized values are very tied to the larger political economies of civilization. And in civilizations which have been wedded to, when I say hegemonic, I mean highly expansionist, militarist, imperial kinds of destinies, which has pretty much characterized the United States close to the beginning, you see the domination of these kinds of values, even though, and in that book, there's a kind of historical analysis which argues that these moral, that these hegemonic pursuits, while they're usually quite brutal and exploitative, are always moralized, typically in these masculinized values, but they're always disguised in moral pursuits. So you see, the pursuit of all kinds of destructive behavior, both economically and military, in the name of morality. So, mm-hmm. These two books that I've done recently are sort of trying to explore one in relation to gender and one in relation to the whole hegemonic system, how the United States has historically functioned to moralize, that is to,
sure.
to add moral credence to agendas which are fundamentally deeply immoral.
You know, Leonard Schlein in his book, The Alphabet Versus the Goddess, gets into this in some detail about how when literacy swept across Europe in the 15th century, that, you know, accompanied on the on the heels of that the printing press, but when the Catholic Church no longer made it a crime to teach your children to read,
mm-hmm.
that within one generation they went from 400 years arguably of worshiping women, worshiping the goddess, most churches were actually dedicated to Mary, not to Jesus,
mm-hmm.
to over a million women being burned at the stake as witches,
mm-hmm.
and to the disposal of Mary worship. And to the elevation of Jesus as the man as the object of worship rather than a woman. And he argues that there's a neurological association with early learning of abstract thinking that's necessitated by alphabetic language. We have about a minute left here, Charlie. What we're talking about, Charles Gerber, the new feminized majority. How do we change American society and the worldwide developed societies to adopt these values,
well,
in your opinion?
In my view, I mean, the new feminized majority and Morality Wars 2 are both, in the end, optimistic books. In the case of the new feminized majority, our argument is that this new, what you might call moral majority, although I'm hesitant to use that term given its historical mm-hmm. connotation, but these values are already very widespread in the American population. It's a rising majority that's already exists, and the problem is there hasn't been a political, you know, a mainstream political party or movement to really assert these values. But you can see with the Obama phenomenon right now that that these new values are coming to the fore, that women are playing a very central role in guiding what's happening in the elections right now. And I think what's going to happen, I'm quite optimistic that many of these values are going to be asserted by social movements in a way that's going to force the Democratic Party to
like
sort of
Eleanor Roosevelt with Franklin, hopefully.
Yeah.
The new feminized majority, Charlie Gerber. Thank you, Dick.
Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Six six 303-2270, our telephone number. Coming up at the bottom of the hour, Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, and then Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Tupac in Phoenix, Arizona, listening on KPHS. Hey, Tupac, what's up?
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
I want to touch base with you on your last guest. That was a very timely subject. And I would just add to it that just as in the times of the original establishment of the Confederacy of the 13 states, the indigenous people, the indigenous nations, the indigenous movement is also presenting a hand. We're putting our hand out to our brothers and sisters of the European-Americans with concepts, experiences, and maybe a few words of advice about what the next steps might be in terms of advancing on the path of our global humanity.
Yes.
I think one of the things that is touched upon by the comments by your guests and also the references that you mentioned in terms of the codification of the thought process that's brought about by alphabetization, in other words, sequential thinking,
right,
and not thinking in real time, is that the societies that are constructed on those models become habituated to designs of behavior that are easily controllable by mm-hmm. doctrines of power.
Yes.
And I think that the indigenous peoples at the present moment globally, not just for the United States society, but globally, we have our hand out to our brothers and sisters about we've got to make the turn to return to our humanity, and we can do it. Of all the countries in the world that can make that process happen with the least painful effect for the Mother Earth and human society, it is the society of North America, including those brothers and sisters of European Americans of the United States.
Well, very well said and elegantly said, Tupac. Thank you very much. And I totally agree. And in fact, it's, as I said, it's the essence of a book that I wrote called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. The one now it sounds like I'm patting myself on the back. I spot on. I absolutely agree with you. And the older societies, the older cultures have, by virtue of trial and error, if nothing else, many of these societies, when they first landed here 20, 30, 40, 50,000 years ago in North America or in other parts of the world, we can see that they engaged in massive environmental destruction, and they learned their lessons the hard way and figured out ways to live sustainably, ways to live that and peacefully. And we can learn a lot from that. Curtis in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Curtis.
Hi, I'm Tom. I just wanted to speak specifically about that quote from Rush Limbaugh that you played. And I think, you know, implicit in that, he says that unattractive women wanting access to the mainstream of society, implicit in that is the belief that women should not have access to mainstream society. And I think that...
Unless they're attractive, in his opinion.
Yes, but I mean, I think...
In other words, unless their only access to mainstream society is as sex objects.
Exactly, and I think that that is such an antiquated and... I mean, a far-right marginalized concept that it may appeal and sell to Russia's audience, and there are people that are going to continue to think of women in terms of sex objects because there's tied up in that there is a biological component that all humans share, you know, male and female.
No, but this sells mostly to men who are insecure about their sexuality, unsure of their sexuality, insecure and afraid basically of their position in society. I mean, the way that sexism has been sold, particularly to working-class white males over the last 40 or 50 years in the United States, and the way that racism was sold to them for 200 years before that, and it's still being sold to them as well, is these people are going to compete with you for your job. And that's why Limbaugh is talking about women, you know, being granted access to the mainstream of society. He's talking about economic mainstream. And therefore, for the sexists among them, you know, if they can keep women if they can keep them limited to just being sex objects, they keep them out of competition with men for their jobs. And what's really destroying the jobs of white working class people in America, and for that matter, people of all colors in America, men and women, but basically what's really destroying the jobs of these guys who are so terrified of women and African Americans and Hispanics and so on, is the practices and policies of big multinational corporations in collusion with our government, shipping our jobs overseas, no longer protecting our jobs domestically with tariffs, not providing things like they do in Europe of like free health care, so you know if you get sick, you're okay. You don't have to worry about your employment. You're not going to get wiped out by bankruptcy. Free college education. You know, just the basic structural stuff. I mean, this is
what. Well, that's a correct and a very complex explanation, but they're just so obviously wrong. Rush Limbaugh and his ilk are so obviously wrong. I think that boiling it down to its base component, that he's saying that women should not have access to the mainstream of America,
That's
American
enough.
Society.
No, Curtis, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but you're right, and I get it. 27 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Kind of the opposite of the discussion we had 15 minutes ago. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. And Christy Harvey with us on the line. She is the Director for Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and edits Mike Check Radio, MikeCheckRadio.org. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great. Great to have you with us.
Fantastic.
A lot of stuff in the news. I'd like to get your thoughts and take on what's going on here with some of these things. First of all, you're reporting over at the Center for American Progress breaking news on wiretaps.
Yes, and this broke this morning. Supposedly, the House and the Senate leaders for the Democrats have come to a quote-unquote compromise with House and Senate Republicans on the wiretap bill, on the spy bill to overhaul FISA. And I put the compromise in quotations because as much as I've been able to read up on this over the past couple of days, the compromise seems to be a lot of the Democrats giving some concessions up and not really getting much in return. So it'll be very interesting to see how this shakes out.
In fact, the New York Times editorialized about it. They say this bill is not a compromise. The
final
details are being worked out, but all indications are that many of its provisions are both unnecessary and a threat to the Bill of Rights. The White House and the congressional Republicans who support the bill have only two real aims. They want to undermine the power of the courts to review the legality of domestic spying programs, and they want to give a legal shield to the telecommunications companies that broke the law by helping Mr. Bush carry out his warrantless wiretapping operation.
Exactly. The two big pieces of this bill, and what it really does, it doesn't just extend that horrible bill from last August, where the Democrats basically said, we're a little bit afraid of what's going to happen in elections. You can just have this spy bill. It doesn't even stop there. It even goes further and will give immunity to the telecoms, and it will also broaden the authority of the government to spy on people without having to get a warrant from the FISA courts.
Now is the time for people to go to callcongress.org and get one of the toll-free numbers or even the toll number if you've got free long distance or whatever. Call the switchboard on Capitol Hill, and if you don't know who your member of Congress is, your member of the House of Representatives, just give me your zip code. If you don't know the names of your two senators from your state, unless you're from the District of Columbia, give them, you know, tell them what state you live in. They will tell you who it is and then ask to be connected and say, hey, no, this wiretap bill, I don't want to be spied on and I don't want immunity for the telco companies. No, now is the time to be calling, and in particular to be calling the House and Senate leadership, Steny Hoyer's office, Harry Reid's office, Nancy Pelosi's office, and saying, you're doing what?
Exactly. And the thing is, there's still a little bit of time. They're not voting on this until tomorrow. So not much time, but still we for once have a little sliver of time in which to act.
You can call for free. Callcongress.org. We've listed as many of the toll-free numbers as we can find right there. Okay. In the meantime, the ExxonMobil, Shell, Total, BP, the original partners in the Iraq Petroleum Company, along with Chevron, they're going to get what?
Yeah, they're going back into Iraq, and believe it or not, they are getting these huge no-bid contracts to go work the Iraqi oil fields.
How do the Iraqis feel about this?
And they're the ones who are helping to extend, and they want to get to the oil that's been, you know, trapped below ground. Supposedly they're sitting on 115 billion barrels of oil right now. But the fact that it's a no-bid contract has just infuriated the rest of the world. They thought that maybe we'd learned our lesson about these a while ago. And they actually, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Total were able to skip over other countries who were trying to offer their services from Russia, China, and India.
Right, which has got to be, it's got to have Vlad the Impaler gritting his teeth right now.
It probably does, but it also is re-sparking a lot of the rumors in the rest of the world that the reason we're in Iraq in the first place is because of oil. And
right.
So it's really doing, the fact that these bids are no contract, or these contracts are no bid, is really doing a big disservice, because it's starting to get people talking about how the only reason we're there is to get our hands on that oil again.
I saw a story this morning, I think it was in the Financial Times, Physicians for Human Rights performed two-day medical evaluations of 11 former detainees and found the actual smoking gun.
They really did. Yes, this group, the Physicians for Human Rights, went in and they examined these detainees, and they found, and I'm quoting their report, they found, quote, clear physical and psychological evidence of torture and abuse, often causing lasting suffering. And this is nothing really new. We have heard all of the stories about the torture and abuse that were happening in Guantanamo, in Abu Ghraib, but this is the first time doctors have said, we've got the proof. We did examinations, and there was torture. And what's really interesting is, do you remember General Taguba?
Yeah.
He's the guy who led the investigation originally into the abuses at Abu Ghraib, and he had a blistering report that came out about exactly what went down there. And he actually attached his name to this report. And he is now calling in a letter he wrote to preface this report. He's saying what happened in these places, quote, is war crimes. And he
right.
came out and accused the current Bush White House of war crimes.
And the president.
And the president.
You know,
and
he
said
the commander-in-chief.
This is Taguba. General Taguba said, quote, the only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account. So he's saying the question is not whether torture happened, not whether or not there have been war crimes, but whether anyone's going to do anything about it.
You would think that a former senior official with the U.S. Department of Defense, a former, you know, was he a 3- or 4-star general? I forget which. But, you know, a major big shot, the guy that the Department of Defense put in charge of investigating what happened at Abu Ghraib prison, the guy who testified before Congress, that having somebody of that stature and that insideness coming forward and saying that the administration and the commander in chief are guilty of war crimes, which is a very specific legal term,
yes,
would be screaming news on all the networks. Stop the presses. Let's talk about this. But I'm guessing that it's going to qualify as I'll be amazed if NBC, ABC, and CBS even cover it in their newscast tonight.
I haven't seen it yet, and I have been watching. This really just broke a couple of hours ago that he detached his name like this. I haven't really seen anything about it yet. It is starting to get a big push on the blogosphere, which these days can then push the mainstream media a little bit. So it is huge, though. It's not like it is a liberal activist group or an anti-war group who's coming out and saying that the Bush administration commits war crimes. This is a devastating indictment of this White House, because it comes from a big shot who used to be in the U.S. military until very recently. He's now retired, but what he found when he did his own investigations was so dramatic, and then what he saw that this group, this Physicians for Human Rights, found really just sealed the deal for him.
Right. And the Physicians for Human Rights, for example, they looked at, these were people who have been released because they were innocent. They never committed any crimes.
Right.
And they said a subject named Amir showed signs of rectal tearing that are highly consistent with his report of having been sodomized with a broomstick. Yasser had scars in his thumbs and irregularities in the contours of his tongue that support his contention that his American captors subjected him to electrical shocks. He said when they shock you with electricity, it feels like your eyes will explode. He bit through his tongue. Three of the Iraqi detainees and one former Guantanamo inmate reported that they were examined by a medical professional during episodes of torture. So there were actually, this is like Dr. Mengele. We had, the United States of America had doctors examining people as they were being tortured, presumably to make sure that they wouldn't die, that we push them right up to the edge of, and then they don't die. This is Rumsfeld's and John Hughes. Oh yeah, well, it's not torture unless you have organ failure.
Well, exactly. And it's also, you know, that was with that secret memo that came out earlier this week about the top-down torture that came from the White House and the
right.
discussions they had.
And George Bush sat in on these discussions.
Exactly. And there was one guy in there who said, you know, if somebody dies while you're performing these rites, you're doing it wrong. Not whether or not you should be doing these
right.
practices at all.
Right. And we now have 108 people that we've documented have died in our custody as a consequence of these things.
Absolutely. And I think that the important thing why everyone should read this Physicians for Human Rights report is the right wing often tries to portray the quote-unquote torture at Guantanamo as, oh, the music's too loud, or they didn't get enough fruit, or they had to stand for too long. And they have a way of trying to make it sound like it's really not that big of a deal.
Oh, this is one guy who they stabbed him in the cheek with a screwdriver. He still has a hole in his cheek.
Exactly. This is showing what's actually, you can't whitewash things like this. You can't whitewash that broomstick. You can't whitewash stabbing a guy through the cheek. You can't whitewash the electric shocks. And those are things that every single American, I think, has to admit constitute torture.
Right. And then we have a general coming out. And then on top of this, it turns out Curveball was a two-bit con man. The L.A. Times talking about this. They tracked down and they interviewed Curveball, the guy who gave Bush, you know, all the, oh, yeah, he's doing biological weapons and things.
Right.
He was working at a Burger King in Germany.
Right.
His co-workers thought he was a crazy man because he was always talking about, oh, they've got all these weapons, blah, blah. We had to track down a guy working at a German Burger King. And he's the guy that Colin Powell and George Bush were quoting. Oh, it's... Christy, sometimes you think you couldn't make this stuff up if you were writing a novel. People would say, yeah, nobody's going to believe that.
Nobody would believe it, and everyone would think it was too mean and dark.
Yeah, indeed. Christy Harvey, the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org, americanprogress.org, micheckradio.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks a lot.
Good talking with you. 45 minutes past the hour. Ellen Ryder, Talk Radio News, up next.
Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you to you for listening to our radio program and to our sponsors for making it possible. 866-303-2270, our number, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us right now, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Hey, well, it's interesting. Today, the Senator Barack Obama said that he's not going to take public financing for the general election. And
he'd be crazy
gave up on his commitment to do that.
Yeah.
And Senator McCain has taken steps to accept public funds. I actually was at the debate in Cleveland, Ohio, when Senator Obama said that if this happened, he would sit down with McCain and come up with some fair way to do this. But I guess when you've got the White House in your eye, that may not happen.
Well, this is a guy who can raise $100 million in a month, and,
right.
and public financing would hold him back, and without going to fat cats, and that was the whole point of public financing, was to get the fat cats out of the system. So
well, that's right.
You know, it
that's
seems right. like he's accomplishing the goal of the legislation. In any case, I think that's the point that he's made, is that it is public financing he's getting. It's from the public. It's not from the lobbyists and the corporations and a few wealthy individuals, which was the whole point of that legislation in the first place. But I get it that the McCain camp is probably going to make hay out of this. What do you think about this two things today? The Physicians for Human Rights, they tracked down a bunch of these detainees and found that, yes, they actually have the scars on their body from electric shocks, from having screwdrivers punched through their cheeks, from being sodomized with broom handles and things as routine part of interrogation while in U.S. custody, number one. And number two, General Antonio Taguba, the guy who investigated Abu Ghraib and made the, testified before Congress, coming out and saying, yep, it's war crimes, and it goes all the way to the executive, all the way to the commander-in-chief.
Well, I think actually, my brother Michael has a case in Germany that puts several of these guys on the hot seat. And remember, with the trip canceled to Germany, then it was back on. I asked my brother about this the other day, and he said, Ellen, I think President Bush and some of his guys may travel, but my guess is they're not going to travel to certain countries after this.
Well, Scott Horton has an article in the New Republic today called Travel Advisory. The U.S. isn't likely to try Bush administration officials for war crimes, but it's likely the European country will. That's very, very interesting.
I think that's the wisdom of people like my brother in Center for Constitutional Rights and some of the other groups that are doing it, trying these guys in foreign countries, because if a case goes to them and somebody steps in their country, then how do they just look the other way once they're not in office?
Right.
You don't have the immunity that you get as being a president or an ambassador or whatever.
Right. And Michael Ratner's website, the Center for Constitutional Rights, is ccrjustice.org, as I recall.
That's right. That's correct. Well, you've got a good memory.
For people who want to help out, well, it's an important website to remember. It's an important website for our listeners to support. What else is going on in the world today?
Okay, quite a bit going on. Senate Majority Leader Reid got a unanimous consent. They began debate this morning on the current housing crisis. And, of course, the Republicans then came out and said, well, they want to recommit to the Banking Committee because they want to know how much Countrywide would benefit from its provisions. And, of course, the Republicans are going after Chris Dodd and Budget Chair Kent Conrad, who they say got preferential loans from the Banking Committee. As you know, Kent Conrad from North Dakota said he's going to give his portion of the preferential loan to charity. He had no idea he was getting it. And both of them apparently knew that they went through the VIP thing, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting a preferential loan. A lot of members of Congress go through VIP from everything from where you sit in a restaurant to where you sit in an airplane.
Yeah, I think that apparently he thought that meant that he was just going to deal with somebody who would return his call in an hour instead of 4 days or something like that.
Also, Majority Leader Reid today also said if the Senate doesn't get its act together and fast, he may actually put everybody through on weekend votes, and he might actually try and make people work through the weekend before the August recess
Harry
of the
Reid,
Senate.
Now, does this have anything to do with Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi being apparently supportive, if what I heard from Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress is correct, of this legislation that the New York Times has editorialized against, which is going to give immunity to the telco companies and to the Bush administration and is going to make it easier for this administration to spy on you and me?
If I'm a guessing person, and I'm actually speaking to you right now from the Senate, Russell Senate office building, my guess is that it actually has nothing to do with it. It just has to do with the fact that the Republicans are trying to stop any bills from going by quickly so that they can then label them when they go home for the August recess and when they get on all those radio rows in the Republican convention and basically say, hey, this is positively not...
it's the do-nothing Congress.
Do-nothing Congress. This is right. They don't do anything. Forget them.
Right. They're going to – well, this is what I think it was Trent Lott said, a year and a half ago. They were going to block all meaningful legislation and then run against the do-nothing Congress, same as Harry Truman did.
And, exactly. Yes. Also, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 ruling found the Kentucky state retirement system doesn't discriminate against older workers, and a lower court found that they were discriminatory because it gave different benefits to those who became disabled before reaching retirement age. They said on a 5-4 ruling that does not. I bet you can guess which 5-4 that was.
The conservative 5 said, "Hey, tough luck."
I think so.
Yeah. Which means that Kennedy is voting with the conservatives now.
Well,
at least in this case.
He is the swing vote just at this point.
Yeah, Yeah, it's amazing. I remember when it used to be Sandra Day O'Connor was the swing vote, and it's interesting. Okay, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, the website. Ellen, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Always great to get our daily update, our dose of what's going on in the world. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, make your reservation now to join me with Brunch with Bernie, our weekly visit with Senator Bernie Sanders for all the news from the nation's capital. He'll be taking your calls and giving you answers as well. Plus, it's Anything Goes Friday, where you get to choose what we talk about. And, of course, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. Don't forget, activism begins with you. Democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You are listening to Tom Hartman.
For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.